And our connection for this hour is made in your city, in your hometown. Think about this question when you think about your hometown or the city where you live. Is it just? Is it fair? Is it equitable? In some ways, these might seem like sort of mushy academic questions that are difficult to apply to the real world, but in the past 2 weeks, everything is on the table when it comes to reevaluating our society. And the Community Design Center of Rochester thinks it's time we do this and do it seriously. They're bringing in Tony Griffin of the Harvard Graduate School of Design, who leads the Just City Lab. It examines, in their words, how design and planning contribute to conditions of justice and injustice in cities. She joins us this hour to discuss her work, and it pushes us to imagine, if our city is not just, what does a just Rochester actually look like? What would change? Our guests include Tony Griffin, professor in the practice of urban planning at the Harvard Graduate School of Design, leader of the Just City Lab, and founder of Urban Planning and Design for the American City. Tony, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Very good. Nice to have you. Thank you. Maria Fergiuelli is with us, Executive Director of the Community Design Center of Rochester. Maria, welcome back to the program.
Great. Thank you, Evan. Glad to be here.
And Nanaya Ando is with us, a board member for the Community Design Center of Rochester. And Nanaya, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Maria, I always want to start with you because you guys bring in maybe half a dozen speakers from around the country a year, and you're trying to get us to envision our community in different ways here. This is a timely conversation as we talk about justice in so many different ways and ideally, seriously, in tangible ways. But tell me why you wanted Tony to come in and what you're hoping the community will learn from this and what you're doing during the pandemic to deal with the fact that a lot of things have had to change.
Yes. Well, like so many organizations, we've had to pivot. Our programs have been interrupted. And one of the things that we were able to do with this lecture series is move our March and April programs to the fall in hopes that we will be able to have them live in the fall. We certainly have been looking forward to meeting Tony and having her share her expertise with our community for several years. And so we're so pleased to be able to offer this program as a virtual webinar in light of the situation currently. But it's always been timely. We started exploring the issue of equity by design in 2016. Our whole lecture series was focused on that. And so I think it's important that we really start to pay close attention and take action. So I think the work that Tony's been doing is amazing, and we hope to learn a lot about it.
And again, as you shift that schedule, what do people need to know if they want to stay engaged with the schedule, Maria?
Well, this program is going to be offered online on Zoom, and the tickets are available through Eventbrite. But just keep an eye on our website, and it'll keep you updated on the current upcoming programs and their confirmed dates. So, and always, please feel free to call us here at the office, and we're happy to give you any information that you might need.
All right, Tony, it's important, I think, that you let our listeners know right out of the gate what the Just City Lab is, what the mission is all about.
Sure. First, I'll give you the website. It's designforthejustcity.org. It is a research platform that I run at the Harvard Graduate School of Design that simply investigates the ways that design and planning contribute to conditions of justice and injustice in our cities. And so we do that through a number of platforms. We've published a collection of essays called the Just City Essays. We have developed a indicator framework for evaluating the presence of good social justice in public life and public space. We have developed a language called the Just City Index, which is a tool that we use to expand the conversation actually beyond equity and to really allow communities, especially diverse communities. And by communities, I mean city leaders, I mean philanthropy, I mean the business sector, not just resident folk, to have more articulate conversations about the needs of communities given their specific conditions of injustice. We also use it as a platform to put forward tools that allow cities, communities, organizations to have these conversations and move towards more just outcomes and practices. And then we showcase a number of projects by designers and ask them to articulate the ways in which those projects are addressing injustice and leaning into various aspects or values that promote greater justice in place.
Let me ask you just about a couple of mission statements that are right there on the front of your website, which is, we believe in justice for Black Americans. We believe design can repair injustice. I'd like to explore that theme as tangibly as we can this hour with all three of our guests, just because, again, I think, you know, this is a moment where it feels like everyone is much more focused on actual tangible solutions and maybe saying, okay, this time, we're not going to let a moment pass. We're going to find a way to actually create a better and more just society. So let me start with this, Tony. I mean, what are some tangible ways that design can repair injustice?
Well, there are a few. At the scale of city and urban planning, we can begin to look at the way in which we distribute or do not distribute infrastructure resources, housing affordability, natural resources, and amenities. By investigating and correcting the ways with which those city services and systems and provisions are situated in city and distributed equitably across the city is important. So tools like inclusionary zoning, for example, are very important. The efforts that look at spaces of environmental justice and not locating noxious infrastructure sites only in low-income communities, or situating public housing on sites that have been contaminated. At that broader scale, these are the things that we can do to repair injustice. There are many people and architects in particular right now looking at the carceral system and either calling for the wholesale dismantling of prisons and jails or different design spaces for dealing with criminal populations. We can look at the ways in which we design public space. Public space is the most obvious and accessible space in which incidents of injustice occur. And so how do we begin to design spaces, use different design languages and aesthetics that promote a greater sense of welcoming to all, versus things that perhaps unintentionally exclude others? And that's everything from kids who skateboard on different parts of parks to the ways in which we design benches that exclude homeless people from using the park to the design languages that suggest that perhaps that render visible, I think, the way perhaps low-income people may not feel a space is for them. These are all the questions that we as designers and planners must ask ourselves at the onset of a design problem in order to render a solution at the end that is considered these conditions as a way to move further along in designing spaces that are intended for the outcomes that we envision, like justice or equity.
Tony, do you think your field has a moment, a kind of an open door to achieve more of this or to grab more public awareness of the need as you see it for these concepts, maybe more than 3 months ago, 6 months ago, a year ago?
No. I think we should have been doing it long before now. And that's part of the challenge of living this in the present. I live this every day. Many of you are living this now because it's heightened. But the problem has always been there. The need for awareness has always been there. To the extent that we use this moment of awareness for people, institutions, organizations to learn the truth of what has placed these conditions of injustice in the context of our cities, re-educate ourselves about them, and then pivot towards the way in which we operationalize ourselves to do it long term, I think that's what the moment, that's the moment that is presented to us now. And it's really about each of us as individuals, as well as organizations, and digging really deep and really staying in the discomfort of the moment to assess and learn before we kind of pivot into the change or reconciliation.
Nanaya Ando, do you agree that, you know, that this is maybe a long time coming, that maybe the door is a little bit more open or there's more public awareness, but there's a sense of fatigue in how many people are finally just arriving to some of these needs?
Yeah, I definitely think so. That certainly what this time is making people aware of is that we haven't arrived here by accident. And this is something that we've been talking about as the African-American community for quite a while, but we haven't yet been able to make people aware. And so now that this is coming to the forefront, we're now able to show tangible examples of how the system has really set forth this moment to happen.
Are you optimistic right now that this moment can produce tangible results, Nanaya?
I am cautiously optimistic because this isn't the first time. We've gone through so many periods and we've gone through some moments of unrest where we think this is the tipping point or this is the tipping point. I will say that in the era of the pandemic and what is happening now, maybe this might be the tipping point. So I am cautiously optimistic because what the pandemic allowed to happen is we saw a different shift in urbanism, right, where some streets were being closed off, the public was regaining some access to the built environment, and public transportation was being rethought to make it more equitable, right, to get our essential workers to work as efficiently as possible. So I'm hoping that post-pandemic, these are some things that would be lessons learned that we can continue to move forward.
And Tony, you know, when you say that that you've had to live with this, and that there are plenty of Americans who have had sort of the opportunity, the bubble, the privilege not to have to consider some of the inequity of spaces and design. I think I am curious to know if you think more of the people who have maybe perpetuated some of the inequity of design are willing to see more of it now. And we're going to talk more specifically in a moment. And you mentioned everything from benches that could exclude people who are homeless to design spaces in criminal populations to housing. I mean, we're going to talk about all of those things. But, I sample too much social media, but you see people who are saying things like, I get it now, I see, or I see, there was a pollster, Frank Luntz, was offering a poll saying that post-George Floyd, the views in this country have shifted in double-digit percentages, 20% or more among all the white population about whether, for example, black Americans are treated differently by police. He said just that single incident has changed in 2 weeks' time. And so I guess I am wondering if you think that there will be more people who will have come out of this saying, I didn't see before, I see it now, I get it now, I'll listen.
Well, I think that's definitely happening. And it's been interesting to listen to other pundits and experts in mainstream and social media, and even asking my own father, you know, what he thought was different between 68 and today and every other sort of moment of uprising in between. And one of the things that we do start to see is the composition of those participating in the uprest, you know, is becoming more diverse, that there are more non-Black allies in the conversation. And I think being much more explicit about their support for Black America, what they see happening to Black America. That is important, and I think that is beginning to shift, right? So now, first is this acknowledgement phase, because it's a continuum, right? So now there's acknowledgement. Then it becomes, what do those who are now acknowledge it do? What do they do personally? What do institutions do? You know, and there's a passive sort of ways with which the acknowledgement is leaning into that. There are ways with which perhaps there's symbolic gesturing or change or nodding to it. But then what happens when we all have to sort of change our identities, the way we work, our structures, to then really remove the injustice, because there are lots of people and institutions that contribute to it, whether they believe that is an active or passive act. So yes, we are on a very good sort of place in the continuum with acknowledgement and participation and the growth of allyship. What lends to the cautious optimism is what do then those people do? What do those institutions do mm-hmm. to start to change the ship, turn the ship in the right direction?
Sure. And so I guess I'll ask all three of you this one then. What's step one in that way? In the same way that people who are white may be asking, tell me, you know, sometimes it's as simple as and direct as people saying, tell me what to read. Tell me what to where to learn more. Tell me how to understand more. And sometimes it can be clumsy. I understand that. But I think a lot of it's well-intentioned to understand what does it mean to be an ally for the Black Lives Matter movement? What does it matter to be an ally in a justice movement? When it comes to justice of design, the spaces in which we live and the structure of our society, what's step one, Tony, that especially white but allies in positions of power, you'd like them to understand and maybe think about doing?
Do the work to educate yourself. Like, that's easy, and you don't actually need me to do that. And you don't need me to point you in direction to how to do that. Right? There are no shortage of resources, I think, to begin your path or your institution's path to self-examining itself and finding the ways to self-examine and become more knowledgeable. And, you know, that's scary, right? Because there are implications to that that make us uncomfortable. But I think we all have to get comfortable with the discomfort. And sometimes that's not a self-guided, sometimes that has to be a self-guided exploration, that you can't ask those who have been marginalized and oppressed to help with, right? You have to find your way into that. You have to build your own allyship, you know, in the space of speaking up for justice, and then grow that allyship with those that are white and non-white. So, and what's good is, you know, there are all sorts of really positive, informative, constructive, and critical resources that are circulating through social media, through mainstream media, through Google searches. And so I think, you know, now, unlike ever before, information is there for all of us to become knowledgeable, gain awareness, access tools that are needed to grow the movement, to grow allyship, and to work towards common agendas.
Okay. Nanaya Ando.
This is a personal opinion, but I do think that wherever you live, especially if it is a homogenous, high-end society, you want to advocate for the elimination of detached single-family zoning and advocate for what I would refer to as missing middle housing, which is a multifamily housing unit that would blend into your neighborhood. And this would allow for people of a lower income to diversify the neighborhood and have access to everything that we've been denied for so long.
Maria Frigiuelli?
The Community Design Center has, you know, for a long time taken the position of trying to make people aware of these issues. We're very fortunate in a sense that many people have been working in this space for a long time, and so we have access to amazing resources, including last year having had Richard Rothstein come and present about The Color of Law, which gives so many people incredible insights into the housing situation and how structural racism was baked into that system. So we as an organization strive to help bring awareness to all of the movements, the resources that might be available. Of course, we look forward to we need to have some acknowledgement about what's been happening, and now, of course, we're in the point of trying to choose ways to take action. What again, can we do personally to support and find ways to define metrics and ways that we can start to define a new way of moving forward. So we strive, as always, to be a resource to the community, especially in regards to this issue.
We're talking about just cities, justice in American cities, especially with how spaces are designed, who they're designed for. Tony Griffin, one of our guests, is the leader of the Just City Lab and founder of Urban Planning and Design for the American City. And Tony mentioned housing. Let me read a couple of comments that some leading Rochester voices have discussed in the last few days, Tony, on this. Mitch Gruber is a member of Rochester City Council, and he wrote yesterday, "This is a litmus test. Will the suburbs continue to prevent new affordable housing facilities now, or will this reckoning lead to more affordable units in complexes?" That drew a response from Pete Nabosny, who is a policy analyst with the Children's Agenda in Rochester. He writes, "Yes, but also zoning changes to allow more multifamily development in general. Affordable housing development is somewhat limited by available state and federal funds, but land use is really up to local government. And I'll note that the politically conservative towns of Gates and Greece have actually been much more accommodating of multifamily and affordable housing than east side towns and have consequently become much more racially diverse than east side suburbs," end quote. So there's a conversation already happening about whether this moment's going to produce more embrace of different aspects of housing. What do you think needs to happen when it comes to housing? What are the tangible steps here, Tony?
Well, as I said earlier, every locale is very unique and has its own set of politics around that. I do think, though, it's important, and I don't know if this is appropriate for Rochester because I don't know the culture and politics of that place, but oftentimes the issue of affordable housing and density get conflated. Density looks like a lot of can look a lot of different ways. It can look like the density or the sort of closeness of single family homes or townhouses, or it can look like buildings that seem like mid rise or high rise. And so it shows up both vertically, but it can also show up horizontally. And so it just means that there are lots of different housing typologies that can be used to promote the production of affordable housing. And so I think it's important to maybe consider whether or not density and affordable housing always need to be coupled in that complex. In that context, mm-hmm. It seems like the production of affordable housing is the primary goal, and that each municipality should really be figuring out how to produce a fair share of that for its region. And it may look different from region to region. Again, I don't know the context of what's the right density or mm-hmm. building typology. But it should really be more about the distribution of a fair share of affordability throughout the region.
Sure. And I take the point that every region is different and there's different dynamics in play between cities and suburbs in a lot of different places. Generally speaking, here, there is, and again, I'm going to generalize, and I know some listeners will think this is overgeneralizing, but the idea is the suburbs are pretty white and there's more affluency on the east side and they don't want lower income development. And they elect leaders who will not get on board with that, and that limits some of the options here. Is there a way to deal with the sort of the political inertia that leads to that? Is it political pressure? Is it something else, Tony?
There are a couple of ways. It's obviously very much driven by politics at multiple levels, right? The city level, the township level, the county level, the state level. And all of those things have to work in concert to get the right suite of regulations, laws, and financial tools to make the production of affordable housing work. Obviously, it would be great if there could be a regional agenda about the equitable accommodation and production of affordable housing for a region. Because while we have these geopolitical boundaries, the economies of those boundaries are very blurry. So second, I would say that there has to be an economic argument for why it's important to have affordable housing distributed throughout a region when our economies and places of work are likely distributed throughout the region. And the ultimate cost related to transportation, logistics, movement, distribution of goods and service have an economic implication related to where people have choices to live. So I think it has to be about regional cooperation as well as setting local agendas, and they have to work at the same time. And I think it's also about trying to put forward, you know, the economic argument or the economic narrative for why having a distributed approach to housing choice is important for any city or region.
Okay. Nanaya Ando, how do you view that dynamic in Rochester?
I think it really comes down to a level of engagement with the people in the community. So what I mean by that is right now, when I say affordable housing or low-income housing or density, people have an image in their mind that might not necessarily be positive. So what we need to do is we need to engage them and give them another idea or a different model of what those things can look like so that they become more accepting of it.
Maria Frigiuelli?
I'm interested in kind of promoting an issue regarding integration. So often we have developments that are affordable housing developments, but it still concentrates poverty in one locale. So is it needed to look at policy changes that will promote allowing for mixed-income housing to happen in a way that is truly more integrated and will therefore distribute the poverty or the level of poverty in a way that helps people improve the quality of their lives?
Listeners, if you want to join the program, it's connections at WXXI.org, and it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. Lou in Rochester wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Lou.
Hi. I just had two comments, and one doesn't really isn't specific to Rochester, it has to do with immigration. And I know from talking to African Americans, there are a lot of African Americans that are against immigration because they feel like, you know, no matter, we bring in roughly 2 million immigrants a year, if you count illegal and visas. And it seems like, you know, we warehouse these kids in failed schools, and then we wallpaper over the problem of these failed schools by bringing in immigrants that are educated in other countries. So every time African Americans try to get their foot on the ladder, there's a number of immigrants that are cheaper, and they've already got their foot on the ladder. So it just seems to me like if we really wanted to address some of the problems in this country, we'd start to address the problems with the people who are here rather than continue to bring in wave and wave and wave of more people that we really can't afford to spend the money assimilating. And the other problem, the other issue that I wanted to say was, as far as integrating people, you know, in the various communities of Rochester, there was a man and a wife on Main Street that were beaten up by 2x4s. And if anybody thinks that they want to be integrated, the riots that have been going around this country have pretty much killed it. Nobody wants that in their community.
All right. Lou, okay. Tony, you want to respond? Go ahead. Tony, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't typically conflate the issues of immigration with the issues of African Americans or people of color in this country or in this context. I mean, I think that they are issues in and of themselves, and I don't think that it's an either-or. Or that we
you
should even put them as.
You don't think that African Americans are losing their jobs because of immigration?
No, I do not.
But so then you're a liberal who's deluded.
Lou, can we please, listen, come on, Lou. If we can have conversations and you can disagree with our guests, but if your response to a comment is, oh, so you're a liberal, don't call this program. I don't mean to be rude, but come on, we have to be better than that. There's going to be ideas that come from people with a lot of different backgrounds, conservative, liberal, people who have different experiences. But that's not helpful. I'm sorry. Tony, I'm sorry about that. Let me get Linda in Penfield on the phone next. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, Evan, and hello to all of your guests and to everyone who's listening as we're talking about integrated neighborhoods and diversity and getting to know each other better, really. I want to encourage everyone to really check out on either web pages or Facebook pages who is running for your school board. Check them out. Find out what they do. Find out what their stances are. Find out who are their friends on Facebook. And find out if they represent what you would like to see in your community, because the Board of Education hires teachers. Think about it. This next board that we elect in any town is going to be in charge of educating our children in the post-quarantine era. All right, so they're in charge of that. So I urge all voters to check out who is running for your school board, and you know, if you want to see a diverse, just environment, you know, check out who's running. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Linda, thank you. Tony Griffin, you want to respond to that?
Yes, representation is critical. And participating in the process of democratic decision-making is essential. It does matter how you engage in the activities of your own community, whether it's your block club, whether it's your school district, whether it's your council district, whether it's your city or regional leadership. Our ability and right to participate in the way in which regulations and laws and allocation of resources are distributed towards the things that matter to us is essential, and is essential at every scale. I think it's important, even outside of elected processes, though, for conversations to be happening within our own homes, within our own blocks and communities, within our professional and nonprofit spaces, to help articulate what are the shared visions and values that we're all seeking, where we have common ground and where, as the last comment, we have disagreement, which we are all allowed to do. The goal should be how to have those constructively. And so the Just City Index that we've created, part of the intention behind that was to start those kind of conversations by first determining what values we share in common versus starting the conversation with how many affordable units should we have on this block, right? Because we probably have more shared values as people of difference than we have in trying to figure out how that shows up in more material ways. So we first have to have ways of having constructive conversations, finding where our common ground is, and then doing the work of figuring out how to wrestle with our disagreements, how to start to make those more specific choices in productive ways.
Well, I really want to thank you for taking the time, Tony, to be part of this conversation. And Maria, will you remind the audience, if they want to engage further, what they need to do? Do we have Maria? Are you on mute, Maria?
I apologize.
You wouldn't be the first. It's okay.
We look forward to having Tony visit us via Zoom webinar next Tuesday, noon to 1:30. Just do a Google search on Eventbrite for Community Design Center or Tony Griffin, and we'd love to have you join the conversation then.
All right. And Nanayanda, you heard a lot from Tony this hour. 30 seconds. What do you hope our community, again, can learn and sort of bring forward tangibly, not just sort of academically?
Just to come with an open mind, we are at a moment in time when we can really affect some positive change. We've built some momentum, and we need to keep it going. So please come listen to Tony and come with an open mind.
All right. Maria Nania, thank you. They're from the Community Design Center of Rochester. And Tony Griffin is the leader of the Just City Lab and founder of the Urban Planning and Design for the American City. Thank you, Tony. Thanks for making time for the program.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
And we'll link to you if you want to check out listeners, Tony's work and their website. As I close the hour, I just want to say, for anybody who maybe was confused about the end of Lou's phone call, and Lou, if you want to send me an email separately, feel free to do so you clarify here. But it seemed like what you're saying is, well, since immigration spiked in the last 40 to 50 years, people who are immigrants are taking jobs that black people could have. And there's a lot of low-wage jobs. It sounds to me like you think, well, that's the jobs that black Americans should have. And they're just going to the quote black jobs are going to the brown community. I think you need to reframe some of what you think about who should be in what rooms and jobs. Unless I'm hearing you wrong, Lou, one of the leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement in Rochester said this week, it's not just about saying the right things. It's who's in your boardroom. Who are your bosses? I think that's a powerful point here. Not just low-wage jobs. Much more connections coming up next.